Good morning, friends. Today, we are going to talk about eMERGE value with one of Radnor Meeting's treasured elders, Doug Ross, and this is myself and Lee Hall, who will be having this discussion. As eMERGE is an acronym that stands for empathy, mindfulness, ecological integrity, right action, growth, and then E is for endurance. And so many of these play into what we know of the life of our friend Doug Ross. Doug was a teacher at a friend's schools, and he is a musician. And I believe that he holds the treasures, the ecology for what it has given to all of us and those who he treasures, his family and grandchildren. Doug, welcome.
Thank you. You want me to show you where I am?
Sure. If you look like you're in a rocking chair, but I have a feeling you're outside.
Now, that might drive you crazy. I've always loved rocking chairs ever since I was a little kid. And when we moved here, we had to downsize. And I was told I could not bring my seven rocking chairs. We brought one for in the house and one for the outside. And then the one outside fell apart. And then my friend fixed it up, and then it fell apart again. So my wife bought me this Adirondack rocking chair that's indestructible. And if you get seasick, let me know, and I'll stop rocking. But my wife, who is a psychologist, believes that I'm on the scale for ADD, and the rocking good thing to calm me down. So that's that. Now, here we are at Folkways, and that was 5 years ago that we downsized, and Leo, was so nice of you to come and visit me here. And since we're talking about the environment, all the great things in my life pretty much came from my wife's ideas, which is not to say that I immediately embraced all of them. Being a man, I have to resist. And she said, we need to go to a continuing care community because we're getting older and she has a blood condition and I have a neurological condition. And I'm like, yeah, that's great in about 10 years. But she worked her magic and it was way less than 10 years. So one of the great things about Folkways is that you're not living in a large house that you're heating, especially after your kids have left, and cooling and all that nonsense. And you're not mowing the grass and you're not doing all that stuff. You're in a community, which is an amazing concept for us individualistic people here in this country. And I'm as individual as anybody, but I have come to embrace community. And I believe that is implicit in these values you're talking about. Certainly is one of the Quaker values of the community. And what a blessing to be here with people. And I tell my friends, I'm telling you, it's like reality therapy in some ways, though. Because when I first came, you'd see every couple of weeks there's a picture and a bouquet of flowers for someone that passed away. I'm like, oh. Now it's people I know, people who are my friends. And so that's the path we're all on, which we'd like to forget about. And it's good and bad because it makes you want to treasure everything you have and treasure your family and treasure your friends and treasure your community and do what you can to. Let's jump right into this. Why do I do this? I've got grandkids. We have left them a mess. We have so much work to do. And I'm on stoppage time now. I'm 80. I'll be 79 in a month. And I always used to think 50 was old. Come on. You don't believe that, do you? 80 is old, right? 80 is old.
No.
Yes, it is. I'm not doing any more birthdays. I'm just going to say, happy birthday. It's 79. Like Jack Benny, I'll be like 39, 39. But it is so wonderful to have people to work with. And you're one of my main communities, you two, and Radnor Meeting. And it's just, I'll give you an example. When I got here, a good friend of mine who I went to college with, and I hadn't seen him in a while, he's a very good woodworker. He says, Doug, you got to get in the trails committee. I said, oh, okay. So what we do is mostly guys and a couple of ladies, and they go out and work spreading gravel in the muddy places and building bridges. And we would work on that. Now, my friend Mike, I'm clear, would not be alive if he wasn't here with the people. Because one day he came out and he was just, oh, I'm just so tired. I can't do anything. And he worked for 5 minutes and sat. And the next day, the same thing. And my friend Peter and I, who were good friends on the trail, I said, Mike, you got to see a doctor. And we forced him, practically forced him. And luckily, we have people on campus. Even on the weekends, you have some nurse there. And this doctor called an ambulance after checking him out. And I followed, my friend Peter and I followed the ambulance. Now, luckily, they didn't put the siren on. And we took him to Abington Hospital. And he sat around and took him hours to get in. And finally, they saw him. And they found out he had fluid on his heart.
Oh
So
my
he spent a
God.
couple of days getting rid of that. So he comes back. And we're like, Mike, why did you have fluid in your heart? You gotta. So he followed up with a doctor at Penn. And they did a number of tests and things. And then they said, oh, you have some cancer right on the edge of your aorta. And this doctor apparently is one of the top surgeons in the country. And he operated on Mike after they did chemo and then they did radiation and then he operated and then they did more of that. And Mike is okay 4 years later. He wouldn't be alive. So we all get by with a little help from our friends. So there's my house. It's got a one bedroom and an extended, a little bedroom, which I call my music room, and my wife calls her study. And then we have this patio. Now, some people have sunrooms. My neighbors have a sunroom. And you can't see it. See the windows there?
Yes.
But I can't get one, which I don't really want one because I like being outside, actually outside. Because if I did, I'd be looking in his, oh, what's for lunch? Like that. So this south facing, here's the garden all around. I can't see what I'm looking at. All native plants. And over here on the other side
Oh, wow.
is the garden that the neighbors and I put in. So we have this little courtyard. But when we first came, we're looking at barracks over here. And my friend Frank is over there with Gail. And we said, we ought to have something out here that's. So, of course, the neighbor right across is more. Edie is a great environmentalist. She coached us. We said, we have a white oak because they're the best trees for different kinds of caterpillars and birds and things. White oak is the highest value. And we love river birch, which is bigger, they grow faster. And then, so it's a model forest. We need, instead of having lollipop trees all over the campus, they need to be connected to each other through the mycorrhizal zones. And we have the canopy, we have the shrubs, we have the ground cover, which I'm working on. I'm going to tell you one more story. So I was out weeding around the river birch a couple months ago. And my wife and Frank and Gail were bad because I let the mountain mint grow up all around it and they couldn't see the pretty bark. I said, okay, I'll move. That stuff's very wild and aggressive. But the pollinators love it. You come here in another couple of weeks, there'll be hundreds of little bees and bugs flying around. So I said, I'll remove the ones around the bark. And I'm digging with my trowel because I didn't want to take my shovel and break the roots of the tree. Luckily, I see something move. And I look, and there's this big toad. And I put the mulch there, and the toad buried itself. And I'm like, and I told Edie, and everyone's so happy. You'll see we have a bluebird box over there. We have bluebirds, two nests, fledglings came out of that one. We said, you build it and they will come. The animals are coming in. We're very excited about all this stuff.
So, Doug, I think it's very exciting how you have live at the intersection of a number of such important values, such as community, where you extend community beyond yourself and your wife, Jerry Lynn, your kids, your grandkids, your friends, into the trees and small animals that all live in this extended community that is not just people, but it is people who helps all these other creatures to live, to have a life. That is a basis of ecological integrity of how you live. Wouldn't you think that, Lee?
Oh, yes. Integrity. The joy that Doug felt just encountering that toad brings up this recent meditation that we did with the Merge and Quaker Earth Care Witness together this past weekend. And our muse was a toad. So when we did the meditation, we had a photo of a toad in the sunlight.
Oh.
And the American toad, we had a picture, beautiful picture of American toad from the person who did the photography for the Emerge booklet. And we focused on this very small, familiar species, the very foundation of ecosystems, a champion of endurance. We were looking at the endurance value, the sixth letter in Emerge, and the toad's camouflage changes to match their habitat, so you don't see them right away.
Almost.
In the winter, they dig backwards and they hibernate for the season. And in spring, they emerge into the light and they dramatically rise from the wood chips and the leaves in the natural spaces. They drink through their skin. And there are many of them. And yet today with climate, their population is declining. And the other issues for them, major issues for them, Doug, pollution and pesticide use and increased highway construction. They can't do their breeding because we put roads right in the middle of where they go from their mating places, and they can't make it across. So they're squished. And what we said this past weekend was to the toad, we hold you in accompaniment. Your evolutionary persistence mirrors the stability of amphibian design for 300 million years. You link our lives to the dawn of terrestrial vertebrates. And when we did this meditation, it became very strong sense to me that because these beings, they have endured for hundreds of millions of years, and that they link us to the dawn of terrestrial vertebrates. By the way, that's us. So we have this link to the toad that's ancient. And therefore, it came to me, if I'm wondering what to do for the environment, everything I do to help the toad will help me. And Doug will help your grandchildren.
Yeah.
Everything that I do that holds the toad in accompaniment will help us.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
you
I
know,
think I'm going to say, I think it's wonderful how you are there living at like one of the things that has developed a planned community there, and you are bringing it back around full cycle to embrace all the different ecological elements there so that to live harmoniously.
That's one of my missions, because every community you have, when you're at Radnor, right? And we have to work with each other. But there's things that we can do better, right?
Yes.
The thing I've learned, and I have to say, you have to be a little careful, because let me go back to when I first started teaching at Friends Central. And let me go even further back. When I started teaching in the inner city, and that was actually when they came to Haverford College, and they said, okay, if you come and teach in the worst schools in the city, you don't have to go to Vietnam. And at that point, I had learned about Ngo Dinh Diem and the corrupt dictator of Vietnam. And I thought, I'm not a Quaker and I'm not pacifist, but I'm not going to kill anybody for this guy. You got Buddhists burning themselves, right? So I asked my draft board, I would be a medic. That's all I could do. Now, some person in the draft board said, "Wait a minute, you're going to a good school, you have good grades. Leave us alone." Some angel saved my life because I was 18 years old and the prefrontal cortex was not knitted together. And I thought, wow, I wonder what a war is like. I wonder what a jungle is like. Oh, I'll learn a trade. And medics, the only place they would go is the front lines. So that would be a really, and when I got married and later on, they came to Haverford and they said, if you go to these schools, you don't have to go to the, I said, okay, I like kids. So 12 people signed up, and by Christmas, only two were left. The rest were going to Canada, the reserves were, but I love kids, and I was teaching these. First, it was first grade, then it was fourth grade. And one thing I learned is that everybody, especially children, once you have your food and your safety and your, you want to make a difference. You want to contribute. And we set up, and when I was teaching graduate students, I'd say, we have this backwards. We have this idea that 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 6-year-olds and 15-year-olds have nothing to contribute until you've gone through a bunch of education. And then, so we wonder why we have all these upset human beings, because they're not allowed to contribute. We put them off by themselves, and a few wonderful adults that'll be there with too many kids. And I saw that even, I want to be the line leader. I want to clap the erasers. So I developed a whole program of service learning. And back when there was money in the federal money, the first year I had six principals. Finally, we got a good principal. The second year I was teaching fourth grade, and the principal said, there's a grant you can apply for. I know you want this. I applied for a grant and I wrote this thing for the School for Community Service. I put everything in this program that teachers did not have. Instead of spending my own money, I had money for materials. I wanted to put a greenhouse on the roof. I wanted to have, before we had digital cameras, community aides, young men and women that didn't have jobs would come in, and I paid them to do things with the children. I had a dark room. We built picnic tables for the pocket park. Every morning we had a meeting for business, like what are we going to do today? And I had a wonderful sixth grade girl who was the class president. She ran the meetings, and we would have our math, we'd have our reading, and then we'd get to work. We had 20 students instead of 35. We
Wow.
had materials. Now, it can now be revealed that I broke a lot of rules. If you follow all the procedures, you won't get anything done. So they came to evaluate my program in the first year. And they were like, wow, look at all the things you're, look at these children, fifth, sixth, seventh, mixed ages. We called them retarded. We had two kids from the RE class. We had couple of them from the ED, emotionally disturbed, that's what you call them. I had the children would come and apply. I gave them a little form to fill out. They would take it home to their parents, and the parents would sign it. It was unbelievable what we got done. So I've taken that on. And when I came to French Central, I thought, I've got to have an environmental science. And I made up the curriculum for the eighth grade. I had a whole trimester of environmental science. Now, here's what I want to share with you, because we have to watch out as passionate people. We have to let other people contribute. We welcome them. We offer opportunities, but we don't know everything. We'll learn from them. And I had this whole thing. The kids would, at the end of the, they would take a test, and they would do really well in the test. They learned about climate change back in 1982. They learned about, that's something we did well, ozone depletion. We've gotten that handled. We learned about air pollution and water pollution and whatever. The kids were depressed and disempowered. I'm like, oh, we can't just bad, bad. We can't just. I said, so I put in service every year. they would pick a project to make a difference. It might be to write letters to the editor. It might be to have a, we had Connie Williams, State Senator Williams, came to us and talked about mercury. And we collaborated with her on creating a bill that you have to label products that have mercury instead of just dumping it out there on the shelves of the grocery store. 12, no, 10 kids helped her. They made a movie. They went out to Lancaster to another school. They had a trade-in for mercury thermometers for digital thermometers. The kids did this. Then I had this stream studies. We would go out and I could teach about chemistry, pH, dissolved oxygen, solubility, molecules. I did geology. The kids would do a report, and I would take the best ones and send them to the DEP, my contact. And this person from the Department of Environmental Protection would come out and award certificates to the best students. After 10 years, we're collecting data. I had a student competed with college students on a project and got second place. When I was teaching graduate students how to teach science, I would show them the work that these groups had done, and they'd say, these eighth graders are doing college level work, and they're learning about the environment. And I'm not just sitting there saying, kids, the world is going to hell and you're screwed. I'm like, there are issues. You go out and find them. Community, we did a whole thing in the community, a survey. Then they would develop their issue. And they were proud. I created, actually collaborated, I should be wearing my Earth Force t-shirt. We had this group that came in, it was funded by the Pew Foundation, and we would do this with other classrooms in other schools, inner city schools, private schools, whatever. And we would have a conference at the end and all get together, and every kid would get a t-shirt, and they would show the poster of their project. One of my favorite projects was a girl in seventh grade before I taught her. She was in my service group, and we'd go out to the creek and do cleanups and stream management and stuff like that. And I talked with her. She said, oh, I said, I had dinner yesterday with Jane Goodall. She's like, Jane Goodall, that's my favorite. I read all her books. This 12-year-old girl. I said, oh, you know what? Jane Goodall has something like Earth Force, which is what we're doing. It's called Roots and Shoots. I'm going to order it. And she took it back and read it over the summer. She comes back in the fall and says, here's my project, Monarch Butterflies. Global, local. So she had this group of girls. They studied it. They developed a plan for pollinator gardens with the milkweed in it. They wrote letters to Canada. They said, you got to protect your area because that's where, and Mexico, where they winter. They made this incredible poster. They did presentations about why we should have milkweed and not spray it with glycophosphate. And, you know, isn't that incredible?
That is so energizing for these young kids to be empowered on these issues that really matter for all of us. They're not just spinning wheels, they are engaged. They become part of a community at a very important time of their life. When was that that you were doing that? Was
That one, so we've been working in the environment for several years. It must have been like 1990. But the sad thing is, when she went to high school, she didn't have great study skills and she was getting bad grades. And I think either her family was going to pull her out. She lived in West Philly and they didn't have a lot of money, or they were going to ask her to leave. So since I was close to her, I made my contacts and I helped her get her into a charter school. It was an engineering and architecture school where she thrives. Okay. And so even at a school like Friends Central, and I think that they're making progress. The problem is, especially in the high school, it's so competitive and people are paying all this money because they want to get into some Ivy League school. So it's kind of macho. But I think we're doing better. And I was also blessed in the lower school. Peter Grove, who just passed away 2 weeks ago, was a wonderful teacher. He had my philosophy. He would take the kids out. He built ponds. He built gardens. They would come to me, but that would be maybe two-thirds, maybe half the kids. So the new kids would come in. And when I would go down to the creek, there were kids who'd be like, oh, a daddy long legs. Oh. So I developed a whole program of emptying your end. And that's what I'm telling you. You are the warriors. You have to be careful not to wipe your people out. You have to bring them along. And I would say, okay, the first time we go down there, I would get a couple of kids and say, you're going to help me. Go out and look for some interesting natural things. And we'll put it in this bag. And I'll put in some of my fossils. And we're going to go down and we have a meditation, Lee. That's so important. The mindfulness, I'd say, we're all going to sit in a circle, all 20 of us, and listen. You hear traffic on City Line, but you hear some birds. And then I'd say, and now watch and learn. And I would take the bag and put it in the middle and pull out a lock and look at it. And then I would put it in the middle. Oh no, before I did that, I would give it to my Confederates, and they would do the same thing. And then they would pass it to the other Confederate. And then they would pass it to a kid that didn't know what was going on. And we did this whole thing. We created a sculpture in the middle with leaves and sticks and driftwood and in silence, and gradually bring them in and add other activities where you find your favorite tree. And so that by the time it was every week when we would go down, even in the when it was like 30 degrees, we would go down. When it was pouring rain, or eventually I had to only do that in the fall, they would be ready and they would test the water and they would look for things under the rocks, for salamanders and stuff like that. So you got to bring people along and you have to give them, pass it off to them. When I was a righteous, and we can be that way, I know you guys, and I'm the same way. If we be righteous, like we know, we're not going to bring them along. And there's stuff that we don't know. We're going to learn from them.
I completely agree with you there, Doug. We live in our own, so to speak, cubby holes, our own little area, and there is a vastness to nature that we barely scratch, and even that nature that is close to us. And it is so important to be able to be engaged with that, to realize that is the treasure of life, of being able to have that interactions, and it becomes more and more limited. And what you have given them is beyond comparison for the understanding to everyone to develop their own understanding of how it all works together and the empathy to know that when we hear that there is something in the world that is deteriorating, not right, becomes less livable, less sustainable, that we have a firsthand tactile sense of what that means. Are you familiar with that also, Lee, of how we must have that firsthand experience of it?
Yes, and I think when we were working on the Emerge booklet, which we should say in case people are tuning in and don't know what we're talking about, you can find it at emergevalues.org. And there's like a tape on the top with all the what you can go to. There's an index, right? And you can go and see booklet, right? And you can open this up in PDF form. So it's emergevalues.org. And we started with the graphics with this booklet were birds that people might see on their bird watching trips, because there's something that about bird watching, and we'd like to certainly promote the idea of bird watching, because bird watching, once you get to know who they are and their sounds, and you know you can recognize the sounds, and you know when the migrating birds are back, and you get so excited because you can see the plants that they co-evolved with are suddenly in bloom, and just this beauty of just the sound and the sight of birds. And so many people relate to that. And so showing the pictures of birds, bringing people in, this is who you are, you want to thrive. Your love for the birds and that connection that you have in your daily life to your daily activities is a way of showing love to those you love, right? And so to if we really want to save what we love, we need to accompany what we love. We need to be in solidarity with the living earth. And there have been studies done, right? And you're talking about kids, Doug, some of the kids coming from the city. There have been studies done that show that if we're looking at tall buildings, right? One group is looking at tall skyscrapers. Now, another group, they have looking at tall trees. And it turns out that the impulse to help someone else was so much stronger in the group who had been looking at the tall trees. There was a connection with community, with altruism, with the desire to help someone else. Think about that in the inner city. And how important it would be to understand this, that we need to be connected with the living world that we are born on and we are a part of and that is part of us. To, isn't it interesting? Have a sense of love for others. Have a sense of wanting to create mutual aid opportunities. That connects with our love for the living world. So all those values that Quakers hold dear. Underneath them, there's the ground, right? There's the mycelium, there's the living world. And these values connect us with our environmental work. All of it's connected. If we re revere our living world, we'll revere each other.
That's awesome. And you know what, Lee? The fact that you started off with empathy, I think, is pretty important. And I'm thinking it's to have empathy for people we don't agree with, for ourselves. And I'm going to give you an example. And I realize we have limited time. So I want to say a shout out. I want to make sure I shout out for political involvement and the Hunger Project. These are two things that go along with my environmental passion. So let's talk about empathy in the political sphere. This is really important. I know we don't want Meeting for Worship to become a political discussion group, but I read this in the New York Times, or isn't it terrible, or whatever. But we have values in that meeting. The people, we need to be active, not just to vote, to send money to candidates, to work for candidates, to encourage people who are not voting to vote, to talk to people. So we have a family reunion, which I helped organize, and now it's been passed on to the next generation every year. And after the 2020 election, we had a family reunion in this state park in West Virginia. And my uncle's from Indiana, very conservative. They may not be MAGA, but they're very conservative, were there. And my cousin, who was MAGA. And hey, how you doing, Ronnie? We're talking. And at some point he starts talking about how corrupt the election was, especially in Pennsylvania. I'm not going to sit there. And of course, I got carried away. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm a committee person. I was involved. There's no corruption. We have 64 cases. Republican judges are throwing them out. The one case that we didn't win was a tie, and that was that there were 10,000 votes that came in Pennsylvania that were postmarked late because the post office was closing up these places, and they just held them to see if it made a difference. So 80,000 votes, it didn't make a difference. I went off, and he starts arguing with me, and I can't take it. I'm like, Ronnie, you don't know a effing thing. I'm just like, I was there. This mail-in, and he was complaining about mail-in. I'm like, this is a law that was passed by the Republican legislature of Pennsylvania because they were doing better in mail-ins than we were, and they want to make it easier to mail in. And we have a damn pandemic, and I told my people to vote that way. We had a fundraiser and sent a mailing to everybody and said, vote by mail. We had signs up, vote by mail. You got to get the thing in the mail to your house. It's been double checked, triple checked. You're seeing it. There was no corruption in the thing. I walked out. My brother had been playing golf with him that morning. I don't play golf. And he said, he's been doing that on the golf course. He'll be bringing up stuff. And finally, I said, we can't be talking politics because I'm not going to agree with you. And I calmed down. I calmed down. I went into the room, the air-conditioned room where the uncles were and my cousin. And I came up behind him. I put my arm on his shoulder. And I said, Ronnie, I love you too much to talk politics. You're not going to change me. I'm not going to change you. It's just, and the uncles breathed a sigh of relief because they didn't like this. Later on that weekend, we were playing this stupid card game, Rook, that they play out in Indiana, the bidding game. And I was Ronnie's partner. And we made it a way to be friends. Okay. So I'm saying when we go after people, and we got to be political, we got to be engaged. The ones that are not doable, we still got to know that we love them. And, but we also stand for something. We don't let them talk bullshit and say, oh, maybe. No, we say, where did you get that from? That said, sources are not good. Maybe let's talk about this some other time. Well, this isn't going to go anywhere. And just go back to love, because that's the only way we're going to save this planet is by loving each other, even when we're jerks, even when I'm a jerk, which is happens. And I found out that I learned from my wife, I learned from people that I do not agree with. I learned where my blind spots are. So I want to say, we've got to put energy into the political realm. That's why would we want to switch? You know, I have people that are the wonderful environmentalists, and we're lucky to get them to vote. Why would you want to be swimming upstream with a fire hose coming at you? Now we're just doing a holding pattern. Thank God we put so much in place that the solar and wind are so entrenched that they're actually causing the air to be better,
Amen.
even with the crazy stuff. Now, when we get control again, we got to move that forward. And just like I'm here at Folkways, it's Shangri-La, but guess what? We have these mowers coming here every week, mowing all this grass, and we're cutting down on that. And we'll always have an area, but we're cutting down on it. And we're teaching people, oh, look, these pollinators are actually pretty. And by the way, they're valuable for our environment. I'm looking at a bee right now. Oh, it's, and we have in the Environmental Stewardship Committee, there's a committee that's practices and policies. Practices and policies. And when I would have the kids do their projects, I would say, okay, it's great that you're building this little garden, but what policies and practices in the long run? I like that you want to clean up that block in your neighborhood, but how are you going to stop it from being trashed 2 months later? What teaching? What? Maybe there should be a trash can nearby. Maybe we should have better recycling. You go figure that out. And that's, we got to look at the big picture while we're, but the other thing is, something is better than nothing. It's like my workout program. I don't feel like doing much. You can do five push-ups. You don't have to max out today. And it's the same thing with the environment. Okay, so this thing that we just put out here, we raised all the money. And then the CEO, who I taught his kid when his kid went to Friends Central, he said, wait a minute. You shouldn't have to raise all that money. will purchase the trees and will pick them up and plant them. I'm like, yes, you saved me having to dig a giant hole and I can focus on the shrubs. So that we changed a practice that first it was neighbors can come and build these little things instead of the lollipop trees. And now we're showing it to other neighbors and they're putting them in their courtyard. But the major tree infrastructure will be paid for by folkways gradually. Something is better than nothing. We don't have to have all the heat pumps now. Get one and a plan for the other one. Oh, and by the way, while we waited there 2 years, we found out there's a better technology. Oh, and we also got the insulation in place. So it's all there. Now, one last thing I want to do a shout out, and then I'm going to shut up. Back in 19, when Ed Rendell was a mayor, he would go to everything, every community event. I have a friend who was involved with the Hunger Project, and I knew a little bit about it. He said, "We want you to come to the Civic Center, which had just been built. Ed Rendell is going to introduce the president of the Hunger Project, Joan Holman." So my wife and I, we love our friends. We went down there, and Ed Rendell introduces her and runs off to another event. And Joan Holmes does this presentation. And she says, "The Hunger Project is committed to the sustainable end of hunger in collaboration with the environment." Same thing we're talking about, policies and practices. And one of the facts she came up, she says, "You realize that every day, for every year, 25,000 children under the age of five are dying from hunger or hunger-related diseases, malnutrition." I'm like, my life is all about children. She said, when we first started this work, and it's not all us, we have partners, it was 50,000. It's down to 25,000 now. Let's get it down to zero. So I said, "I'm in." Every month we send them $100. So then I go with the meetings, and it's like what you're doing. We're trying to convince people, save the environment. What can you do? And they would come up with events. And I was, okay, I'll open my mouth. I would run a workshop. We'd have it at my house. I don't know, maybe you were there, Bert. I had a couple at my house. And we would talk to people about this. Okay, maybe I'll send $50. And we up to when Gerald started working full time, I'm like, okay, we were doing 5,000 a year. I'm like, finally, when my kids are in college, we got to cut it back to 1,000. And in these workshops, people would say, "Oh, I get it. You teach a man to fish and then he can fish." No. The people in Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Kenya, the countries they would work in, already know how to fish. It's let's get the fence around the pond. Let's change the policies. Let's make the transportation so that they can sell their pots so that they can, let's look and see what's missing. And maybe you build a pond in the village. So people get the idea. We teach a man, it's like there's more people are competent. If we come from, oh, these starving people in Somalia. In Somalia, you have to send food. It's a war. They're going to starve. And we have a food program. And our country was doing better, of course, and we just cut all that stuff out. Now we cut out the AIDS program that George W. Bush put in. We were doing pretty well. Not now. But that's not enough. It's sustainable end of hunger. The people need not to be going out of the village to the city where the men contract AIDS and bring it back to the village and send some money back. The villages need to be sustainable. So finally, Joan and I said, since we're giving this money, they invited us to go to Malawi. So we paid our own way. We went to Malawi. They had one of the women who was leading. She wasn't the leader of the project, but she was a leader. Oh, she was a leader of the whole country. Malawi is a very poor country, way more poor than Ghana, which we'd been to before. And they took us in a van out to a village. 1,000 people come running out, drumming, and we had a meeting. Now they have to translate because they're speaking a language I don't know. And this woman gets up there and says, "Hey," and these four other women, "we borrowed 60 bucks each from the Hunger Project and set up a business. And I would take these little calves and raise them and sell them. And then I made enough money and we all promised to pay it back. And we would support each other in paying it back, the $60 that we borrowed. And then I put a metal roof on my house, which is like having a Mercedes-Benz. And then I adopted five AIDS orphans and paid their school fees and put them all in school." My wife and I were like, "We waste $60 in lattes. This is like my friend Lee Hall that gives away her car." It's like, so we stepped it up. It's like when you're in a community like that and you see what can be done, you become a bigger person. You're more generous. You're more like, "I never would have gone to Africa and see people and meet people." My daughter went to Ghana for a semester, and why couldn't you go to France or England? That's, they didn't even have internet. It would take 2 weeks for her to get a letter. But we went to Ghana, and while we're there, we saw the Hunger Project. It was like, my world has gotten bigger. If we can get people to be mindful and empathetic and to love themselves and to take risks and to get involved, voting is good. Maybe you should run for something. Maybe you should be on the team. Maybe you can be their manager. Maybe you could be the committee person. But everyone has something that they can do. And that was Martin Luther King's. Everyone has something that they can contribute. And it's not, "Oh, these poor people, we have to help them." They are very competent people. What can we do? Maybe we need to get out of the way.
Totally agree with you, Doug. Lee Hall is someone who knows about expanding the world through empowerment and generosity. Lee?
Doug, I would have, in the spirit of everyone bringing something to the table that they know, I would ask if you might check out this group that I support. And the website is awellfedworld.org, a well-fed world. And what they're looking at is plant-based hunger solutions. And they make the and perhaps the group that you're working with, the Hunger Project, you might be able to bring some ideas and cross-pollinate some of this if you look at it and find some things of value here. But they look at a well-fed world looks at the idea of feeding us all with plant proteins as a very important climate support system. And it also talks about food insecurity and how the animal agribusiness sector is a primary driver of food insecurity and disparities. So I would ask you to look and see if you can find something that may translate into the work you're doing now. And I want to bring this back to somebody that we mention and cite and draw inspiration from in the book, in the Emerge booklet. And that's Benjamin Lay. And Benjamin Lay was a model of a well-fed world in a sense. Benjamin never used any land to grow feed.
Wow.
Benjamin's land was to grow food direct. And so Benjamin Lay, who was the abolitionist in the 1700s in the Philadelphia area, Benjamin Lay married a Quaker minister. These were thoughtful people
That's a power
who
couple.
decided they wanted to live They sent a message with the way they lived. They may not have talked about it all the time because we were very busy in the abolitionist movement. They moved into a cave and they built a library in that cave and they fortified it with stone walls, and they lived so sustainably because of that, the way that they built their home. And you know what they ate? They ate fruit from the fruit trees that Sarah and Benjamin planted, and they ate melons that they grew on their land. And when they were asked, when Benjamin was asked, "Why aren't you riding a horse into town?" Benjamin said, "Why should I make someone else work for me?" So Benjamin saw empathy in the whole great sphere of it, and how we're connected to all other living beings on this earth. So the idea of making sure that everyone has enough to fulfill their needs is so connected to the climate and environmental work. I can't look at climate work without understanding it as also supporting mutual aid and respect among humans, respect for the earth, respect for its living communities beyond humanity, but including humanity. All of this is connected.
Wow, you know what? I am number one. I'm gonna tell me the name again.
A well-fed world. And if you look at it, I can send it to you too, and Bert can put it in the notes on this podcast. But it's all one word when you type it into your search engine, a wellfedworld.org. And it's got so much wonderful information. So that's one group I support. I also, by the way, do support a group that does plant-based food in Gaza. It's called Planting the Land. I support that group as well. So I'm completely on your wavelength. It's just that I want to focus on not having the animals being commodities in that dynamic. That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah,
But
well,
I think we can learn from each other, and I think we can cross-pollinate on this.
I'm going to definitely. Here's the thing. I have a good friend who's very involved in administration of the Hunger Project now. And I don't know if they're aware because they do a lot of partnering up. And I think that would be a, they would be a good partner for that group. Now, so when we went to Malawi, they did a whole food security thing and they had a building that they had with saved up grain and stuff like that. But they also had an aquaculture pond that they were raising fish and eating the fish. And for me, it's to have someone like Benjamin Lay, and I've learned more about him. I've just learned more from what you said about that cave. I never heard about that. And about this wife, what a power couple that would be.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when you mentioned bird watchers, I have a bunch of bird, and I really love my bird watcher friend. They're some crazy bird watcher friends. I'm not. Like I'll go with them. Oh, what's that? And I learn, and it's not my thing, but I'm more appreciative. And it's also like I flew on a plane to go to Malawi with a long flight, and that's not the most. And we're cutting way back on that because, unfortunately, we can't really. I used to love to drive in long distances, but I can't drive on highways at all now. But sometimes, if people are mindful and you know you're using the technology, it may be a temporary leverage to do something to get there and get some people together that need to be together. So I appreciate that. But I think that this would be a really good match. I don't know if the Hunger Project has already got some projects. And they're working in, they only work in countries where it's not a war going on. And they also, we raise money and the total budget's like $20 million. It's like a helicopter blade or something. I get so pissed off people talking about, what about all that foreign aid? It's going for weapons in Israel. It's like the foreign aid is a drop in the bucket and most of it's military connected anyway. So it's ridiculous. And people are like, we can't spend all that money on foreign aid. The AIDS vaccine that's saving mothers with from passing AIDS onto their baby. So give me a break. But I feel like that kind of partnership can only be powerful. So If they want to work in a country and they've raised maybe $800,000 and get ready to go to Cote d'Ivoire, the first time they went, they said, "We expect you to have at least 25% women of the leaders that we're going to work with." And they had none. And they said, "We're not working with you because when women are empowered, the kids are fed. The kids' infant mortality rates go down. You don't have 12 kids." If women in India, they work in India and in the villages, mostly in the villages. And when they learn how to read and they see a map and they learn their rights, when the once a year the government official comes in, the women's sat around his jeep and said, "We're not leaving until we have a promise of water in this village. We're sick of walking 2 miles every day to drag this water here. It says right here that's the project that we're supposed to have, and we want to see it." So those are countries, some in South Africa, Mexico, of course, about six or seven countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Bangladesh. But if there's ways for them to partner, that's got to be a good thing. That's, thank you for bringing that up.
Oh, and Doug, thank you. You have given us so much today about community, empowerment, empathy, sustainability, and all of that is foundationed by love. And you've given us much to aspire to, and we
I'm
want to
honored to
thank
be
you.
asked to be on your podcast. I hope people don't say, "Who is that whack job on chicken?"
I think we need to start a trend, and we all need to get on our rocking chairs and do podcasts from the rocking chairs.
That's right.
Rocking chairs.
That's right. I got my two rocking chairs, one outside and one inside.
was wonderful.
Here
Doug.
at Folkways, I have geothermal heat. I have the barn is a thrift store. When these people come and they have too much stuff, we don't throw it away, and we raise all the money for the fabulous concerts that we have. Oh, and the lumber that was going to be thrown out from the kitchen renovation, we pulled all the nails out. That's what we build the bridges with. We saved $20,000 worth of lumber. We have glass trays that we bring back for recycling. Keep upping our recycling. We keep trying to cut down on our plastics. And we have this group of people that are like the climate change. They really can be annoying, I'm sure, to the CEO. We're like, we bring things up and then they say, "We can't do that now, maybe next year," and then next year. And eventually, it's all good.
Yes, we have cradle to cradle projects.
Yeah.
Sustainability. Thank you both for being us with us today on this Emerge podcast. Doug,
I'm
Lee,
glad you're
been
here.
wonderful today.
Lee, I'm glad you can make it. Thank you.
Doug, thank you. And Bert, thank you. It's love you both.
Love
Love
you
you.
too. Bye.
Peace out.